everybody. My name is Bernadette Russell and welcome to How to Be Hopeful, a podcast all about hope, where to find it and how to keep hold of it once you have found it. This is episode number 12 and it's the first one that I've recorded at the end of lockdown, or should I say at the easing of lockdown when we're supposed to be alert. And anyway, everybody knows the beaches and the trains and the parks are full of people and we're all struggling to work our way through it. So I've been really delighted to continue to focus on thinking about hope and thinking about the challenges to our hope at the moment. And this week I'm really so happy to have had the opportunity to talk to a wonderful chap called Ben Walters, aka Dr. Ducky. You'll find out all about that soon. Basically, I was really pleased to speak to Ben because we're in June and it's at the very end of Gay Pride Month, so it seemed really appropriate to chat to Ben about Ducky and also to speak to him about his PhD, his work and his concept, Homemade Mutant Hope Machines. I can't tell you how happy this conversation made me, how joyful and brilliant, and also how joyful and brilliant and colourful and vibrant and creative and beautiful Pride Month is every year. For those of you who don't know, the reason it's in June, it was to commemorate and celebrate the anniversary of the Stonewall riots, which took place in 1969 in June. So you can hear a little bit more about that at the end. But without further ado, please sit back, kick off your kitten heels, and enjoy listening to my conversation with the wonderful Ben Walters. So first of all, could you just introduce yourself to us all and tell us how you are at this moment?
So my name is Ben Walters, and I've done a few different things in my time. I've been a journalist and a filmmaker and a programmer and a campaigner, and I've recently finished doing a doctorate about homemade mutant hope machines and queer fun, working with Ducky. We'll talk about a bit later, I'm sure. And how am I feeling at the moment? I'm feeling okay today. I've actually been quite down the last couple of weeks, and I'm pleased to be feeling a bit more up the last couple of days. So I'm okay.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear it. It feels much more manageable to answer how you are today, because it's changing so much from day to day at the moment, doesn't it? So how are you feels like too general a question. It's like I have to think, well, right now I'm sort of all right, but so yes, want to talk about all of your amazing work, which I found incredibly inspiring, and I mean I can't praise it highly enough. But just before we sort of dive into that, obviously, as you know, the emphasis of my podcast and the focus of it is about hope. So I'm trying to ask everybody to perhaps share one thing this week that has made them feel hopeful and or happy, if they have something, and what might that be and why, if you're able to.
Yeah, well, I suppose at the moment I have been feeling quite hopeful about what's been happening around Black Lives Matter protests, and to an extent around what's been happening with the conversations around trans rights and trans lives as well. And I suppose I'd say hopeful rather than happy, that I don't think either of those are situations to feel happy about. But I feel hopeful in that it feels like there are more, that there's more realization more broadly around these kinds of structural injustice and inequality, and that even though it's recognition of the scale of the problems, which of course in themselves are terrible, you know, obscene. But the idea of a greater recognition of the scale of the issues, of the complexity of the issues, and of the responsibility of the issues being something that goes far beyond the people who are most acutely affected, that feels to me like a necessary stage of getting anywhere in addressing them, far from saying that they're being addressed. as it is, but I think there's hope in the, hopefully the evolution of those conversations.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I've found it hopeful that there's a lot of conversations going on about a recognition of what we don't know, what we need to know, what actions can be taken, so that there's a sort of individual responsibility being taken up, as well as a recognition that it's also there needs to be system change and, you know, other stuff. So I feel hopeful because of the conversations that have been going on, I think, and the exchanges of information and the sort of complaints, although it's intense. My friend said to me yesterday, 2020, it's a lot, isn't it? And I thought she perfectly encapsulated. Yeah, what more can you say? It is a lot. Thank you for that, Ben.
And we're not yet halfway through.
We have a long way
to... As we speak now.
I know, it feels like enormous.
But I do think, I mean, in some ways, I think it does sort of go to the heart, I guess, of what I feel about hope. That to me, hope really is just the belief in the possibility of better worlds. And change is absolutely at the heart of that. And the fact that this year is so, so fluid, so chaotic, and in so many ways that is, you know, that's destructive and that's harmful, and we know there's so many negative things that have come out of that, but just the fact of change to me always opens the door a little bit towards hope, because change brings uncertainty, and when we don't know how things are going to develop, to me usually there is then the possibility that they might develop in positive ways that we can't necessarily anticipate at this stage. But the possibility of change to me does mean the possibility of change in the right direction.
Absolutely, absolutely. We don't know what the future is yet, so it could be fabulous. It could be, though, yeah.
It could be.
Yes, as I think I said to you, when I started my hope investigation, for when I was beginning to write my book, your email dropped into my inbox. Now, so I know you as Ben, and it sort of reintroduced you to me as Dr. Ducky, which I absolutely loved. And then I think the message was homemade mutant hope machines. And I was like, wow, that's sort of beautiful serendipity and what an amazing coincidence. And it was just very exciting and inspiring to think about it in another way. So hugely grateful to you. I'm sort of aware that some people are listening might not know what the heck we're talking about. So I wondered if it's quite a large task to task you, whether you might be able to explain what and where Ducky is, the amazing Ducky.
So Ducky is a queer performance collective that began in London in 1995. And they began doing Saturday nights at the Royal Vauxhall Tavern, doing their own weird sort of different kind of club night. It wasn't what you were getting a lot of in the 90s gay scene of sort of shiny, muscly, high-energy part, MDMA, lots of that going on. Ducky was more booze and rock and roll, sort of David Bowie, Kate Bush, and weird short performance stuff on stage, kind of live art, performance art, cabaret, weirdness, old Cockney knees up stuff, just bundling that all in there. So they've been doing that on a Saturday night for 25 years. Then they also started doing these sort of bigger events. They started doing, on Gay Pride weekend, Ducky started doing Gay Shame, which was their sort of satirical kind of take on the whole Pride thing, which is a bit of an institution now. They also started doing bigger performance nights, or sort of theatrical runs, really, not plays, but things at the Barbican or at the South Bank Centre, of these kind of, you know, productions. And then about 10 years ago, they sort of took a bit of a swerve and started doing a bit more in the way of community projects, things which were still sort of rooted in a queer performance sensibility, but were maybe working sort of behind the scenes rather than in front of an audience, and were then working with different groups, whether that might be young queer performers, but might also be people who are homeless and living with addiction, or it might be older people who don't have a lot of family and friends. different things like that. So that's the sort of ducky thing. And because
I have to say, well done, Ben, because well done, because it's quite a thing to summarise.
Well, I mean, it's just an amazing crew of duckies. Yeah. And it's still it's the same six of them doing Saturday nights that started doing it 25 years ago, but it's also a big, you know, there's hundreds, if not thousands of people, certainly, you know, punters, thousands and thousands of them who are sort of ducky, part of the ducky family, and hundreds of performers, producers, volunteers, all different people who might be involved with one project or another crossing over. So it's this amazing sort of big network of people. And of course I started going to ducky when I was a teenager, I guess, when it had just started.
You started going in the 90s, Ben, is that right? You were going?
Yes. Not on a hugely regular basis, I must say. But I did. I first went. It must have been within the first year or so of it starting in 1995, because it was one of the first clubs that I did go to when I came out, little baby A, aged 18 in 1995.
Can you remember, when you first went, what your impression was, or how that sort of affected you as a young man who just come out? Do you have any sort of recollections of those early experiences at ducky for little Ben?
I mean, I do, and they were hopeful, I suppose, in that I'd been to the first ever gay place that I went to was Heaven, which was in 1995, you know, quite shiny and muscly and high energy. And it was amazing, and it blew my mind, but it didn't really feel like me. I didn't really feel at home there. I thought it was fantastic, but it didn't make me think this is the place for me. Whereas ducky, because it was a bit more, a bit more boozy, a bit more sort of slightly studenty in a certain way, because it came just after Pop Stars, which was a sort of studenty indie gay night, and having the performance, having this combination, I suppose, of this slightly kind of satirical perspective, but also having a real sense of care and fun and affection. And I do remember, I was very, very drunk, but I remember one of the first times I went, David Hoyle was performing, who is an incredible, amazing performer who I've been lucky enough to work with since then. But I remember he came on as the Divine David, as he was then, was sometimes described as a kind of anti-drag queen, very deeply satirical and deeply charismatic and deeply talented performer. And I remember he came on as the Divine David with his sort of grotesque maquillage and extraordinary outfit. And that he did some material as the Divine David. And then I remember he came on later, sort of out of slap, as it were, sort of in his kind of civvies as David, which I don't think he'd really done much before. And I remember being blown away by that, and the way that there was this space to play with performance and ideas of authenticity and self-presentation. And I remember finding that incredibly powerful and moving, and then being sort of disappointed when he came back on as the Divine David again, and thinking, there was something so sort of powerful and vivid about him just being there on stage with us. I was very drunk. I mean, I think, I don't know how much of a sort of analytical lens it would really stand up as, but so ducky was the sort of place where that kind of thing would happen. And you could also get drunk and dance with your friends and have a snog and that sort of thing. So I think, you know, it's a really powerful sensibility.
And obviously your connection has developed and changed quite considerably since then. So could you talk a little bit about that, about how?
Yeah. So then I became Time Out London cabaret editor, which, of course, is how we first met. when you were doing the amazing stuff with White Rabbit and all those fantastic kind of spoken words and walking tours and all that brilliant stuff. So I already sort of knew the Ducky Gang a bit by that stage, but then I'd write articles and I got to kind of be a bit more engaged and have more conversations with them and stuff like that. And then, unfortunately, Time Out cancelled the cabaret section after a few years. It was about 4 years that I was editing that section up until the end of 2013. So that was a chance to get to know the Ducky Gang a bit better, because, you know, we were sort of collaborating professionally in certain ways around me writing about them. And so then, as it happened, in 2014, so after the Time Out section had closed, Ducky had got together with a university, with Queen Mary University of London, and essentially they'd got funding together for somebody to do a PhD about Ducky, and particularly about these community projects that they'd been doing kind of since about 2010. And so, long story short, it was sort of too good not to apply for, because Ducky, amazing. A chance as well to develop some of these ideas that I've been able to develop while doing the cabaret section around what I've come to think of as a kind of queer civics, an idea of these certain sorts of performances and community events and things going on that were really, you know, that were fantastic, entertaining, brilliant performance stuff in themselves, but were also actually modelling alternative ways of doing society, really, alternative ways of structures of care and accountability and self-expression and all these different sorts of things, which I really got to realise were, you know, every bit as important as what happened on stage, the stuff that happened off stage to enable the work, and the fact that with cabaret, there's no clear line between on stage and off stage anyway, and that there's no fourth wall. It's all about, it's different every time, and it's the way that that became clearer and clearer to me that there was huge political power in that, and in the fact of it being fun, which maybe we'll come back to.
No, really, really want to come back to that, because that's, I have to say at this point, you presented, you courageously summarised your incredible PhD on stage at the Royal Vauxhall Tavern in an hour with the lovely Simon Casson and a blackboard. And I'm going to make sure that the link is in the copy to this podcast. It's extraordinary. And well done again, summarising an enormous piece of work and a lot of thinking. So much love in it and fun in it, which was great. So I'd recommend to everybody to watch that and to read the PhD, and I'll make sure that information is there. But I just, and obviously I'm kind of asking you now to summarise it in an even shorter way, which is cruel and impossible. But I just wondered, in terms of your idea, Homemade Mutant Hope Machines, would you be able to sort of illustrate or tell us about an example of one Ducky project which created a hope machine, and explain, unpack that a little bit so people can understand what your ideas are?
Yeah. once I was lucky enough to be chosen to do this PhD about Ducky, basically I then spent a couple of years immersed in these community projects that they were doing with these different groups. Which were all amazing, but were all sort of completely different, because they were all tailor-made to the different groups that they were involved in, whether it was, as I say, sort of young, emerging LGBTQ plus performers, or people living with homelessness and addiction and mental health. So there was like a summer school for young queer performers to develop a bit of work. There was a kind of drop-in art project based in homeless hostels. There was an afternoon cabaret event for older people who don't have a lot of family and friends and support network. So I was looking at all of these different things and said, these are all amazing. They're fantastic. I love them. They're great. I could see how they were changing people's lives. But they're also different how to connect them. what is it to write a PhD? How do I sort of bundle these all together in a way that makes sense? And so that's what I ended up coming up with, was this idea that, oh, these are all homemade mutant hope machines.
Which has got to be the best title for a PhD ever.
Well, thank you. It caught in my mind, so I stuck with it. But so in a nutshell, what does that mean? Well, so the core of it is this idea of hope machines. So it's the idea of a machine just being anything that routinely generates a given output. And so in this case, just a hope machine is anything, any sort of form or process that routinely generates hope, that routinely helps people believe that better worlds are possible. And a mutant hope machine, that's a hope machine which can adapt to changing circumstances, because times change, especially for sort of queer people or people on the margins, when things can be quite precarious and uncertain. So it's useful to be able to sort of roll with the punches, as it were. And the homemade bit is the sort of two aspects of that. So it's thinking of these hope machines as homemade, first in the sense that they come out of people's lived experience. So they're not someone outside looking in saying, oh, here's what you need, drop down from above. It's actually coming out of what people's own wants and needs really are. And the other aspect of homemadeness is to do with operating relatively autonomously, which is a tricky one. It's very complex, but it's fundamentally the idea that the more you're able to operate on your own terms, under your own steam, then the less accountable you are, the less you can be kind of shut down from the outside, essentially. So homemade mutant hope machines. So an example of a homemade mutant hope machine that Ducky do, for instance, something like the Posh Club. So the Posh Club is this afternoon cabaret that they do for older people who don't have a lot of friends and family, don't get out of the house that much. So they put on this incredible event in the afternoon. So it's sort of modeled on Ducky Saturday Nights in that it's got performance and people dress up very posh. And they have beautiful, you know, volunteers done up in black and white waiters attire and serving tea and cakes and sandwiches and bubbly and juice, and there's raffles and shows and all, you know, it's just beautiful and wonderful and happy and fun. And the guests themselves are, you know, a huge part of it. They're not just kind of punters who turn up and sit down. They're the lifeblood of it. And they, you know, they dress up in their own styles and they dance like nothing else. And they perform as well. Increasingly, they kind of perform on stage. So how is this a homemade mutant hope machine? So it's a hope machine in the sense that it's basically, it's this routine thing that lets a bunch of people who often don't have much social contact, don't necessarily have much pleasure or variety in their lives, it lets them know that there is this place that they can go to every week where they will feel happy, they will feel connected, they will feel able to express themselves on their own terms, they will feel like they can engage with crazy performance stuff, some of which is pretty risque.
I know, I have to say, when I, because I was lucky enough to be part of a Posh Club, and I was taken aback in a delighted way at how outrageous the entertainment was. I mean, it was Ducky level outrageousness, you know, what I was used to seeing at a Saturday night cabaret. And it was enormously well received. There was a little bit of, ooh, but in a really in a delighted way. I mean, really incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, you know, and it's a space where also some of that slightly more experimental work, sometimes there are people who don't like it and who think that's too much. I don't like that, or I don't approve of that. But that in itself can still be accommodated within that space. But if someone says that, then it's perfectly possible to say, okay, that's fair enough. We respect that. this week, I guess it wasn't for you, and that's okay. And hopefully next week it will be for you, as it was last week, because, you know, the balance is still weighted towards stuff that everyone will enjoy. But it's possible in that space to test people a bit, to have kinds of constructive disagreement, that it's okay for people to say, actually, I don't like that. That's not for me. And people could say, that's all right. Not everything is for everyone. And that's okay. And we will make sure that there is something for you. And so it's part, you know, part of it is not pretending that everything is always, you know, all smiles and Pollyanna for everyone all the time. But it's saying, well, that's all right. Maybe if this week wasn't your cup of tea, we'll make sure that, you know, next week or the week after or whatever, we will be making
different
sure
tea
that...
bags.
Exactly. So that's the sort of basic Hope Machine aspect of the Posh Club. It's homemade. It comes out of lived experience because Simon, you mentioned Simon Kaplan, who's, you know, sort of one of the original fans of Ducky. Basically, his mum moved from Hackney to Crawley in Sussex, where she didn't really know many people. And Simon's sister, Annie, one afternoon put on a little tea party for their mum and her friends. And that was really nice. And then they put on another one and made it a bit bigger. And Simon sort of got involved and they started thinking, well, actually, there's quite a lot of people who are going to benefit from something like this. And maybe we can call some of our mates who perform and we can talk to the local church hall and, oh, actually. And so it kind of, so it emerged from lived experience in that way. And then it kind of mutated and it went through these various forms, started out, you know, in their mum's front room and then moved to different spaces, went through different formats of, you know, what kind of performance or what sort of, you know, at one stage they were offering haircuts at one point, but then sort of realised, no, actually people want to come looking their best. So they went through these different things that you only do by experimenting and by mutating. And then it's fairly autonomous. It's sort of, you know, that Ducky are really good at getting funding from different places. So it's funded in ways that let them do what they want to do on their own terms. And it's now in, or up until the beginning of this year, was in a handful, five or six places around the country. You know, there are times when there's a Posh Club on every day of the week. And then they've mutated during the pandemic in terms of putting some stuff online and working with some of the guests in different ways. But then also it sort of mutated out into performance groups.
Yeah.
So guests who started going to the Posh Club as guests to have a nice afternoon out have formed dance troupes that have performed at Sadler's Wells, that have performed at Ducky's Gay Shame in
wow.
the and you know in an arch in Vauxhall at midnight on Pride weekend.
Yeah, that is amazing.
Doing their thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, and the way that these things do then start to connect is really hopeful as well. That when you find these projects that do give people a kind of validation, if that's not a patronising word. But I think what's really powerful about these projects is that they find ways for people to sort of express themselves, to set their own terms, to do their own thing. And that is empowering. And you see the pragmatic sort of extensions of that, that then these projects start to sort of overlap and combine. So, as I say, people from the Posh Club can then come and perform at Ducky. And you have all these other sort of cross-fertilisations going on.
It felt, when I listened to you talk and now listen to you speak as well, it's a great source of hope, and it's important as well, is that people can see this happening. They see it happening. They bear witness to it. And they see in a way that it is, that it's all kinds of people. And that is sort of hope self-generating as well. I think if you see that it's possible to do something, it's easier to imagine that you might be able to. If it doesn't look remote and as if you've got to be, I don't know, super posh or have a special palace to do something in or a lot of power. So yeah. I think that's a lot of power in the sort of DIY quality of it, you know, just get a room and a teacup and you can make a start, I think is really powerful. Do you think then that hope is important, is an important sort of fuel, particularly for people who, for whatever and many reasons, have been excluded or might feel on the margins or have been ridiculed, that hope is an important sort of ingredient in the empowerment of people who might feel like that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it is important, exactly like you're saying, to think of hope as a habit and as something pragmatic and something that's sort of demonstrable, that's accountable to sort of, you know, straightforward real world, what you see with your eyes and what you do and what you feel. But as I say, to me, it's hope is just the belief in the possibility of better worlds. It's not even that you have to think it's likely. I mean, to me, that's a bit of a difference. But different people would use words in different ways. But to me, that's the difference between hope and optimism. To me, I have my sense of optimism is that optimism is an expectation that better worlds will happen.
Yeah, possibly without making an effort. It's connected to me with wishful thinking, which I understand has a really important place as well. It's psychologically, it's an important sometimes to just cross your fingers, of course. But hope is a more dynamic thing for me. I think it sounds like it is for you.
Yeah, and it's just the belief in the possibility. And that when you believe that these things are possible, almost as a matter of, I mean, sometimes almost as a matter of survival, that sometimes it can be on a really basic fundamental level, you know, do you think is there something worth getting out of bed for today? Depending who you are, that can sound like a negligibly low bar, or that can sound like the highest bar in the world.
Oh no, it's enormous sometimes. And at some point, most human beings will have experienced the difficulty of getting out of bed, truthfully, at some point. Absolutely. I think a thing that you do brilliantly, Ben, and that Ducky does brilliantly, and I think it's important to say, is also gift hope. Because the other thing about presenting these kind of hope machines and talking about things like this is a gift of hope for someone else. So if you're like, nothing's ever going to change, everything's awful, I feel terrible, by example, you were kind of gifting hope. You're presenting, look, we did it. This happened. So hope as a gift, I think, is also really important. And we can give it to each other. We can say to each other, come on, it's all right. Let's just get together and try and go for a walk. Or let's try and get together and write for half an hour in the morning, whatever that is. So,
oh, absolutely. Or even smaller than that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the idea of just, you know, of if you're feeling bad, like I've felt pretty bad the last week or two, not, I don't think, in any sort of direct relation to specific things that are happening in the world. Obviously, it's been a tough year for all of us, but I don't think in any specific way. I think it's just, I don't know, I'm no expert on mental health at all, but to me it feels like sometimes a bit of kind of mental health flu, essentially, that I just feel like, oh, do you know what, you know, this week I'm just not feeling very good. And to me, there's a bit of, and you know, and I'm very lucky that I'm not, in terms of mental health, it's not, you know, I'm fortunate enough not to suffer from serious mental health issues, so I'm not comparing it to that. But for me, just feeling like, oh, do you know what, this week I feel a bit sad and a bit low and a bit shit, and that's okay. And there's, to me, it's sort of hope, because I haven't always felt that way. There's been times when I felt low, and I would then beat myself up about it and tell myself, well, you you have no right to do to feel like this, or you still have these things that you have to do. Da, 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 da. And I think just even just to be able to say, oh, do you know what? This is not my week this week. And you can still have the rational understanding of, well, and I'm still actually not in terrible danger. Luckily, it's all, you know, I'm not in a crisis, thankfully. I'm just a bit depressed. I'm just feeling a bit shit. And that's all right. I don't then have to beat myself up about that as well. So that's a little hopeful thing. And then if you can do that, then all right, well, actually, maybe a walk might be quite nice. Oh, actually, maybe I am up for a conversation with someone. Oh, actually, maybe I can write something. Oh, maybe I can do something for someone else. Maybe, you know, that these things, that the hope of it, I think, is in the doing, and in the kindness.
It is, and however small that doing is or that kindness is, that little thing's enough. I think that's really...
Absolutely.
That tiny thing is enough.
And because that's really it. All you need to be able to do is to say, well, actually, has it been a bit better rather than a bit worse because I did that thing? And if you can answer yes to that, then that's a general principle. You know, you might be answering it about the little thing of being kind to yourself when you're feeling down, or having, you know, stopping to smell the roses, or coming together with other people and doing something positive, you know, but it's the same principle that goes up to massive structural change in society. It's just possible. It's possible. That's all it is. It's okay. Oh, so actually it is possible for things to be a bit better rather than a bit worse.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. 100% agree. I think another, just to move us on slightly, because one thing I thought that you spoke about, which for me was so delightfully radical, was the conversation around fun, because I don't think it gets spoken about enough, especially in relation to sort of, you know, kindness and hope and stuff like that. Fun rarely comes into the conversation, and I'm really interested in the radical possibilities of fun, as I know you are. For me, especially if you're involved in activism or social change, or even just because you want things to be better for yourself, you can burn out, fun can feel really remote, everything gets a bit serious and glum. And you described fun beautifully, I think, Ben, as being disruptive, and you talked about the power of fun. And I just wondered if you could talk to us a little bit about that, what fun means to you in your work, and why fun is important in relation as well to your machines.
Yeah, well, so fun in terms of hope machines, I think of that there are sort of several ways that I've sort of tried to identify that you can turbocharge a hope machine. And one of those, I think, is fun, and particularly queer fun. And I think, yeah, fun, I think, is really interesting. It's really fascinating. And our society basically tends to trivialise fun in a way that it's almost now so supposedly commonsensical that it's obvious. It goes without saying that if something matters, then it can't be fun. And if something is fun, then it doesn't matter. And I think that sort of actually misses out quite a lot of quite interesting things, because I think, to me, one of the key things about fun, when we're having fun, and it bundles into this whole idea about triviality, is that fun, when we're having fun, we think that the stakes of what we're doing are low. It doesn't matter. It's a low stakes kind of thing. So I think but obviously it's very pleasurable, and it's very in the moment. And it's very stimulating and absorbing. And so it plays out in a range of different ways. So I think in the first place, sort of maybe the most obvious thing is that fun can just be really restorative. So sometimes, you know, when you're worn down, you need a bit of fun to recharge your batteries, to feel good, to get the endorphins flowing, that sort of thing. And I think it's quite useful, because fun, by definition, I think, is limited. It's bounded. It starts and stops. bounded in space and time. It's a limited thing. So there, it's like, so you could sort of, you can have fun and you can make a claim for that, and it's a smaller claim than saying, I'm happy. That's a much bigger, amorphous sort of thing. But you can say, oh, do you know what? Actually, yeah, we had fun for an hour, and that was great. So at least it's sort of a bit contained. But I think that's just really where it starts, because I think fun is actually a really powerful social technology, because it's bound up in these ideas of seriousness and what's at stake and how much does it matter. So actually, fun can be a really powerful way of intervening in existing power structures by opening up questions of, well, what deserves to be taken seriously, and what are the stakes of different things? So things like, I think like a really good example is the Gay Liberation Front in the 1970s would do these kind of carnivalesque protests and interventions where they disrupt, you know, kind of reactionary so-called Christian festivals by turning up as, you know, nuns in drag and releasing mice and doing all this kind of thing, and protesting outside psychiatrists' offices, you know, when there was still huge amounts of conversion therapy and all sorts of, you know, really negative stuff, but doing it in these kind of dressed up, where, you know, giant prop nets to catch the loonies, you know, this sort of cartoony stuff.
Yeah.
Which actually turned out to be these really powerful forms of protesting, precisely because they were accessible and engaging. They got people's attention in a positive way that people were like, oh, what's this? And then could actually start to understand some of what was at stake, some of what the seriousness was, without feeling confrontational. It also made it much more difficult to police these sorts of things, because as soon as the police start to engage with this kind of thing, they make themselves look ridiculous. They make themselves look preposterous, arresting a bunch of comedy nuns who are just, you know, having a sing song. And it starts, you know, that when people sort of let their guard down a bit, it starts to open up some space for questioning and for really thinking, well, what is actually at stake here? How seriously should we take this thing or that thing? And then the other aspect of it, which I think is the most exciting thing, is that actually fun is really performative, meaning that in the sort of academic sense, not of it just being like just for show, but performative in the sense of it actually brings things into being, that certain kinds of fun actually start to create new ways of being, new forms of self-expression, new kinds of relating to one another, new kinds of ethics, new kinds of agency and action. And these things that start from people valuing pleasure in themselves and valuing novelty and surprise and all these things that we think of as part of fun, which don't matter, because, I mean, we can get into the whole thing about capitalism and fun.
Yeah.
But essentially, when, you know, that when, you know, from the outside, when authorities think that fun doesn't matter, then it means that actually they pay less attention. But when people themselves think that fun doesn't matter, it means they give themselves permission to try new things, to be in different ways, precisely because we understand it as a space that's inconsequential, even though I don't think that is true. The fact that that's how we tend to understand it means that people let themselves off the hook.
Yeah.
And so that's where you then... So many of the homemade mutant hope machines that Ducky do, and all sorts of other people, because, of course, Ducky is just the group that I was studying when I came up with this particular formulation, this particular turn of phrase. Of course, lots of other people have talked about this kind of stuff in this sort of way, in lots of other amazing ways. But it's not just Ducky, that all these other things that I think of as homemade mutant hope machines, like, you know, the ballroom community in the US, around the world, things like, well, so many sort of new cabaret performance things like drag syndrome, to a group of people with Down syndrome. They're fantastic. And there's all these other sort of groups there, but also, I mean, there's so many.
You also made me, as I was listening to you, Ben, I was reminded of how, well, a couple of things. One, how actually there's a very, very old tradition of people who have been pushed to the outside, sort of playing naughty tricks in order to challenge those in positions of power. I was thinking about, if you think about the clowning and fools and all of that sort of area of laughter and fun poking at power seems to be connected to that as well, doesn't it? It's like, if you're making a joke, it's very difficult for the person in power to tell you off in the same way as they might if you were shouting. So it feels really powerful and important for that reason. And also it's got really, there's a lot of history. There are a lot of people standing behind us should we choose to do that. And it just, yeah, there are lots of sort of really positive examples. Plus, why not also let's have sort of activism or the efforts for social change to include joy and laughing. Why not? You know, it feels like...
Well, absolutely. And there are these very, very deep sort of cultural, political currents that people like Barbara Ehrenreich and Lynn Siegel have written about fantastically well, that these sort of legacies of the carnivalesque and this sense of, you know, that really until sort of historically quite recently, until sort of modernity, sort of, you know, Renaissance onwards kind of thing, that actually what we now think of as the carnivalesque in terms of, you know, massive groups of people in public singing, dancing, drinking, having sex, doing, you know, big public pleasure.
Yeah.
That actually that up until relatively recently, there's an argument that is indistinguishable from political change. That any kind of political change, in fact, only came about through those kinds of movements. And there's these very interesting ways in which, for instance, that kind of carnivalesque thing weaves in and out of religion and the church. And that looking back, you know, aspects of the sort of early mid Christian church had quite strong strains of this within religious practice and within social change. And these kinds of movements are really fascinating, and that we now have this sort of sense, as you're saying, that there's this kind of legacy of the carnivalesque, of the satirical, of the jester, that we still have this notion that fun can be used to prick pomposity or to hold a mirror up to the power structures, and we do recognize that legacy. I think we recognize slightly less this other legacy, which is that actually those things aren't, those kinds of ways of being don't only have to be useful as a mirror or as a satirical intervention. They can also start to model whole other ways of being.
Yeah.
And in a way, that's the bigger challenge to existing authorities. You know, it's still challenging for them to be told, ha ha, you're absurd. Don't get too big for your boots. And we're here to, you know, do a funny impression of you to make sure that you keep it in proportion. That's important. But actually, it's another thing to say, oh, actually, we don't even care about you over there doing your thing. We're finding new ways of doing our thing over here outside of your structures. It's one thing to intervene in existing structures. And of course, often that's absolutely vital when people are facing violence and oppression. And of course, it's important to deal with the injustices of existing structures. But actually, to me, the really exciting thing is what happens when you say, do you know what? Your structures aren't working. I'm not even going to spend my energy telling you what's wrong with them. We're going to do something else.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, very, very good point. And actually, there are lots of great examples, but ballroom's a really great example of that, I think. And lots of people will have probably seen Pose, so they might be sort of familiar with that sort of example.
And the sense where all of these things that I've been looking at in my studying really do come together around you know, performance and community and family and fun, and showing, you know, I think ballroom does show really powerfully how actually the ability to have your own fun on your own terms can be absolutely central to a livable life.
Yeah, and can actually create work and, you know, financial autonomy for people, can provide work and income, yeah, practical things like that, which feel really important. I'm glad actually you mentioned family, because I wanted to speak to you a little bit about that, because I also loved, well, many things you said, but one of the other sort of things was about family and community, and about intergenerational transmission, so we don't have to keep reinventing the wheel. And I think there's something really important and connected to all of your work about the hope that can be generated by finding family, different kinds of family, and communities, different kinds of communities. How would, if someone was listening to this and then were like, actually, I don't feel like I fit in and I do feel isolated, to just take sort of baby steps towards finding what might be a better family for them or what might be a community?
Yeah, I mean, it's such an important question. And I find myself asking myself that question. I don't necessarily feel like I have all of those things for myself in the way that I ideally would like to have them. And that's, you know, it's complex. And in my case, that's related to, you know, that I'm very privileged in all sorts of ways and have not been at the acute sort of sharp end of the kinds of oppression and exclusion and marginalization that a lot of people are. And so I can't pretend to be able to speak for someone who is actually in that position. But I suppose I think, again, it's the sort of baby steps kind of approach. I think in a way the first thing, which is so hard, is recognizing in ourselves what it is that we need, which isn't always the same as what we want.
Yeah.
And I think that's very that is very challenging. But I think hopefully we all have some sense of that. And I think then it's I guess about trying to think about things in terms of reciprocity and relationality, of thinking about, I think to me that, you know, it's the fact of connection is almost more important than the particularities of a given situation, if that makes sense.
I've had quite a few conversations about this with people who, for various reasons, have felt isolated, who've talked about actually finding, you know, finding communities online, finding communities through social media. So those things, which are sometimes seen as dark spaces and negative spaces, actually, I guess, open up other possibilities of connection. So they can be positive, but they often are. They can be really positive spaces. And I know certainly quite a few people I've spoke to were like, I would never have found this group. I'd never have found these people without Googling, I don't know, whatever it was, you know, people who like parkour or over 70 or whatever it is, you know.
Yeah. So no, absolutely. And I think in some ways, I think if you're conscious that there's a specific aspect, a specific need, a specific interest, a specific desire, that you know that's where you're at, then Google is your friend.
I was just going to say, what you said I think was really important is the first bit of work feels like getting to know yourself and working out what it is you need. Like the first bit of work, doesn't it?
I think so. And recognizing that you know, that maybe what we need is also that we have a need to give, and a need to be seen, and a need to to see and to witness. And I do think that I think it's important to start, I think, you know, trying to establish, I don't know, sort of channels which have a sort of reciprocity, and to think about, well, where is somewhere that I can provide something? You know, that sometimes when you feel like you need something, actually looking to see, well, what can I give?
It's a beautiful thing to think about what you can offer. It's very empowering, and it serves self-care and kindness outwards, doesn't it? To think, what can I offer, is a really wonderful thing, I think. Really hopeful thing as well, to think, actually, this is what I can give. It's my knowledge or a skill or company, whatever that is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think at the moment as well, I think with the sort of the pragmatics of the whole pandemic situation, I think there's a lot to be said for sort of starting on your doorstep. Obviously, if there are specific areas of specific interest, Google is your friend. But I think just in terms of feeling connection, of seeing and being seen, I think especially now, for practical reasons, as well as I think very, very genuine deep reasons, actually, you know, well, what is happening on your doorstep that you think is a good thing for whatever reason, and can you help? Can you do something? And then the fact of doing something is hopeful and is mood elevating and all of that. Then you'll probably get to meet some people and get a bit of a sense of what's going on and where there might be space to relate.
There has been lots of that going on, which has been very encouraging, I think, popping up all over the place, which is lovely. I'm just mindful of the time, Ben, and I don't want to miss a couple of things with you. First of all, if somebody wants to read your PhD, see your amazing presentation at Ducky, I will make sure that the links are on the copy for the podcast. But otherwise, where might people be able to get in touch with you or find out about you or talk to you about Hope Machines? Where's the best sort of first stop?
So we've got a sort of website, which is part of the Ducky website. So if you go to Ducky, which is ducky.co.uk/Dr. Ducky, D-R-T-U-C-K-I-E. But yes, yeah, so basically, if you go to that bit of the Ducky website, then you can see an introduction to these ideas about Hope Machines. You can watch this 1-hour talk, as you say, which I gave as a sort of version of the research, which is sort of meant to reach the people that the research is for and about. And you can also download the whole 100,000 word thesis if you really want to get into the nitty-gritty of it all.
It is a great read. I'm on page 48 now, so I'm doing well. I do like a long read. And lastly, I love that when you were doing the live presentation
I was just going to say, I didn't actually quite answer your question, but on there is also contact information, so you can get in touch with me through that bit of the website.
Brilliant. So it's like your little hope section of the Ducky. I was going to say that I loved at the end of the live presentation that you asked the audience to consider what their own hope machine was, and you obviously got some amazing responses to that. I could see by your face, and you asked people what routinely gives them hope, that it might be a habit, an event, an object, a relationship, an organisation, or if it doesn't exist yet, what might it be, which I thought was a really powerful question. So I just thought we should put that out there, Ben, and see if anyone that's listening has ideas for that, and then they can send it to you via that contact on the Ducky website. I like to give people something to do, Ben.
Absolutely. But yeah, I mean, that's what's so nice about being able to do that kind of live version of the research, and trying to do it on the video version as well, of actually getting people to try to think about these things. But these hope machines, it's, you know, it's not saying that Ducky make hope machines, and that's it. It's saying, here's a way of thinking about some of these Ducky projects that can also be used to apply to so many other things that give people hope in a routine way. So yeah, so we just ask people to write on little index cards if they come to see the talk what their hope machine is, and it's such an amazing range of things that people come up with. Some of them are things that are a bit like the Ducky project, that might be something like the Cocoa Butter Club has come up a few times, which is an amazing kind of cabaret performance group for by and for and with people of colour, and other things like that, like Drag Syndrome, like these other kind of performance groups. But also some people say that the library is their hope machine. Some people say it's the diary under their bed, or a particular memory of being told that someone loves them, or a political group that they're part of, you know, for working for sex worker advocacy is one of the ones that came up. Or things like zines. Zines are amazing homemade hope machines. Or venues like the Vauxhall Tavern or other queer venues or things like that. Or could even just be like a WhatsApp group that you're part of. Or a friend of mine who's become part of like an online, you know, they do like a weekly quiz night online during lockdown. And that's turned into this amazing, creative, expressive community sort of thing. So, yeah, it's just,
it's a very nice thing to focus on, actually, and it's lovely hearing other people's ideas, because when you hear them, you're like, oh yeah, you can kind of take them for yourself as well. You're like, oh, that's a good one. So it's sort of it kind of ends up providing this sort of framework and structure of hope to hang your own hopes on. So I think it was just a really lovely sort of lovely participatory way of getting people to engage with your idea, which was absolutely brilliant. We're nearly out of time, but I just wanted to ask you, Ben, this is a huge question, really, and quite lighthearted, CD. But what might be your idea of utopia? And you don't have to have one if you don't have one. And if you do, what could be a tiny baby step that you could take towards your utopia?
Yes, it's a very good question.
It's massive.
I mean, I suppose my idea of utopia would be something along the lines of a sort of place where everyone and everything is able to flourish on its own terms, by its own light, in harmony with everything and everyone else. Which is quite vague, I guess, but in a way, it's sort of, to me, the point would be, a utopia would be a place where I'm being constantly surprised and delighted and astonished and presented with things that I would never have in a million years be able to think of or feel or understand or come up with, and to enable everyone and everything to sort of be the most of themselves that they can be. And I don't know that we can ever get there, probably not, human beings and all. But I think in a way, I suppose a baby step to getting there, I think, is, for me, it's trying to value the fact of connection, the fact of communication across difference, the fact of uncertainty, of being okay with that, of being okay with making space to try to learn, to try to develop, to try to surprise oneself and find new parts of oneself and of the world. And I think that, I suppose, that does sort of bring us back to hope in the sense of hope as I said, as being a matter of habit and also a matter of uncertainty, that hope is only possible when there is change and that you can't have too, I don't think, too fixed a sense of a sort of end point. I mean, obviously we can have certain very important specific goals for justice and things like that, but in that sort of macro sense, to me, it's the unknowability, which is sort of where the hope is. But I don't think of hope as a specific destination, or even as a map to get to a destination. But I suppose I think of it as a bit like a compass, that you might not know where you are or where you're going. But it gives you some sense of how you might start to think about trying to get there.
That's lovely. Thank you so much. I feel refreshed.
Thank you.
It'd be lovely to be in your Roman God environment with you. Thank you so much, Ben. I hope you have a lovely day.
Oh, thank you. You too. Thank you so much. It's been really lovely speaking. Put a smile on my face. And thank you for everything that you're doing.
And I'll see you soon, I hope.
I will look forward to it.
Bye, lovely.